It really is the never-ending story. Boris Johnson insisted a Brexit deal had to be done this year. Despite the pandemic, he pushed ahead. Now the January deadline looms, but he can't clinch the deal. Today we ask once again, are we on the cusp of a crash-out exit?
The EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, says the UK has taken three steps back from its original commitments and risks a no-deal Brexit at the end of the year.
The general atmosphere here is that the no-deal option becomes the most likely.
He might crash this part of Ireland out of the European Union. That would be a very dangerous course of political action.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we're joined by Katie Hayward, Professor of Political Sociology at Queen's University Belfast and Senior Fellow with UK in a Changing Europe. She's the Brexit watcher extraordinaire and will be giving us the lowdown on the latest state of play with the talks. Is it all bluster, or might Johnson really crash Britain out? You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org.
Hi, this is Alina. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then, but that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
Hi, Katie, welcome to the show. So we're recording this on Thursday the 10th of December and it's going to go out on Saturday morning. That sounds like a little bit too much detail, but it's just to explain the fact that we don't know what's going on. What we do know is that it's exactly 3 weeks until D-Day and the cliff edge. Last night in Brussels, Boris Johnson ate fish with Ursula von der Leyen and tried to break the logjam. Katie, what actually happened?
Well, we don't know exactly what happened. We know in detail what they ate on their menu, and we know the comments made afterwards, which is basically that they had, I think, a lively discussion, although they say they understand each other's positions, but they remain very far apart. So if you were trying to judge what might happen next and the significance of that, well, I guess the positive thing would be that we didn't have any major dramatics. Johnson drove away relatively calmly. There wasn't any big walkout, for example, which possibly could have been a concern if he really thought there wasn't a chance of a deal. And we do have now David Frost and Michel Barnier given a few extra days to continue to talk. What they've been waiting for, and this is why that dinner was important, they've been waiting for political guidance and a bit of leadership. And when you're looking for the politicians, you're looking for a bit of leeway, maybe indications of where there could be meeting points that directly involved negotiations can't decide for themselves. We expect then maybe that happened a little bit, given that Frost and Barnier are, so to speak, back in a room.
It seems like these negotiations have been going on forever, but of course it's only been in this pandemic year where it's been happening. And just our sense of time is so warped these days. What are the areas of disagreement? Every time it's been discussed this year, they seem to still be exactly the same. Could you remind us what they are?
Yes, I mean, you're absolutely right about these negotiations seem to go on for a long time. And indeed, this week has been a long week already. I coined a phrase earlier, Brexitensity, which is this sense of tension and intensity around these Brexit negotiations. And yet at the end of it, you're not sure if much progress has been made. The reason why it feels a little bit like Groundhog Day is because, as you say, we've known these stumbling blocks for a long time. So there's a question of governance overall, which is absolutely key to all of this, given that the UK has taken the attitude it has, apparently, with regards to the previous deal with the EU, withdrawal agreement, i.e. threatening to take unilateral decisions around the protocol. So the EU is extra cautious now about how this new deal, if there is one, will be governed. And then there are the other questions in relation to state aid, in relation to level playing field, which is basically the EU being wary of the UK managing to have competitive advantage over the EU, whether that be in terms of lowering environmental standards or in subsidising certain industries. And the EU is really going to be very careful about that. It's not going to give a Canada-style deal because of the proximity of the UK. The UK, of course, emphasising the question of sovereignty, no jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice, etc. But we've heard some interesting possibilities around a get-out or get-arounds for those challenges, possibly using a bit more imagination to find enough for a deal and then manage it as a sort of going concern into the coming years. And then, of course, fish is the last outstanding issue. And for something that constitutes such a small part of the UK's economy, fish is just really overwhelmingly dominated the UK-EU deal and the prospects for it. This is one dimension of this potential UK-EU deal, which gets into the question of particular member states. And we know that France, for example, is particularly engaged in that question of fish. Again, there is a landing zone for it, but all the time both sides are thinking, can they sell it?
All these pictures we've seen of Johnson and David Frost looking really shambolic next to Ursula von der Leyen and Michel Barnier. Do either of you think that was at all deliberate, that they were kind of looking like they'd been dragged through a hedge backwards on purpose?
I can see what you're hinting at, Zoe, but the question is, do they ever look any different?
Yeah, I suppose so. And my second question is not trivial as such, but it's more about kind of speculation, which I know you're both a bit too kind of careful intellectually to engage in. But, you know, the battle on Twitter is this just Boris Johnson taking us to the edge for drama and he has no intention of going with no deal? Or is this just Boris Johnson whipping up kind of nationalistic fervour because he has no intention of making a deal and therefore he wants to kind of drum up some hostility towards the EU by having this very performative showdown with them?
As our listeners will know, I've always been an extreme no-deal sceptic. And it's interesting to hear you frame it like that, Zoe, because in some ways, I don't feel that this is a moment of great nationalist fervour. What I think it's a moment of is kind of disbelief and refusal to accept that this might actually be happening, if that makes sense. If you compare it to the environment in, I don't know, September, October 2019, where the entire political class and the media and Boris Johnson were obsessed by the idea of no deal exit with the EU, and then Johnson got a deal and ran on the Get Brexit Done election. I think there's just such a high level of public exhaustion with the issue this time that that just doesn't wash at all. And I don't know whether that makes a no deal more or less likely, you know, the lack of kind of drama around it. And I suppose the question I have in my mind that I don't know the answer to is, because he wants this very light deal anyway, there's this argument that it's going to be chaotic whatever he does. So the difference between no deal and a deal are not as great as they would once have been. What do you think, Katie?
Yeah, just to pick up on that last point, so today on the 10th of December, so after that meal, the EU has issued its no-deal notices. They still have to be approved by the Council, but essentially, I think this is very clearly, you know, making a statement to the UK, which is, listen, you know, a deal really would make a difference. So the no-deal notices are, ironically, on fish and on transport, to basically say, this would be disruptive, we would be not giving you loads of leeway, and just to really sort of try and drive home the fact that there is a big difference between a deal and a no deal, albeit not as great a difference as we might have hoped for, if you see what I'm saying, you know, if we'd had gone for a comprehensive agreement. I mean, more broadly on the question of whether Boris Johnson wants a deal or not, I mean, it does depend on to whom you listen. And I'm always so wary of thinking about the personality, because you hear a lot about, you know, well, basically, who was the last person to speak to him and make an impression on him, and maybe that'll shift him in one particular direction or another. And, you know, the contrast with the EU And this is something that's just become increasingly apparent. You know, Michel Barnier has to carry all the member states with him, all 27 member states, and he doesn't say anything without getting the full approval of those member states, or it has to be, you know, aligning with the mandate given to them. So extremely cautious, not personality based at all. And then you contrast it to what we're left to do vis-a-vis Johnson, and just imagine really well what's going on in his mind. And this is why I think it's so frustrating. Part of why we are where we are now is because, of course, the EU took the clock off the table. So that ticking clock, which the UK always thought was for its advantage, i.e. push the EU to its deadline limit and then it'll make concessions at the very end, the EU's just determined not to walk away now. So there's no sort of point at which they hit a wall.
Yeah, the EU has played this one really effectively, I think, in terms of putting the decision on whether to go for a no deal or not firmly on the British side. And if there is a no deal, I think that will help them a lot ideologically and in terms of their legitimacy in the future. On, I know we're going to get back to the serious issues at the moment, but did you or listeners see that incredible exchange, which has nothing to do with this, but tells you an awful lot about Boris Johnson, where he was asked a question in Parliament about a protest by farmers against the Modi government in India during Prime Minister's questions, and clearly just didn't listen to the question at all, and gave a answer that was totally focused on the India-Pakistan conflict, and then sat down again. And it's like actually terrifying that he is the Prime Minister at this kind of moment in British history, because he has such disregard for information or detail or the content of political decision making. It's quite extraordinary.
I actually saw that clip. I watched it because Another Europe Is Possible had tweeted it. So I'm not saying I'm a complete PMQ wonk, but I saw it. And what I felt like, I didn't think it was that he hadn't listened to the question. He looked like somebody who was like in a job interview for quite a high powered post in like the WTO and was answering a GCSE question. He looked like somebody who didn't have a clue what had happened with Modi and the farmers, which is weird, right? Because it was on The World at One, so everybody had a clue. And he was kind of too incompetent to even say, I'm afraid I'm not familiar with this issue. So I think it's kind of worse than him being kind of caught on the hop. I think it's more that he completely just doesn't have the most fundamental engagement with the outside world and thinks he can get away with anything.
Yeah, I mean, it was a cognitive failure. That was the terrifying thing about the statement, because there's so many things that he could have said in response, which would just be along the lines of, yeah, well, I share the Right Honourable Member's concerns, and if he has written to me about it, then I'll make sure I reply and talk to the Foreign Secretary about it, and then sat down again. But he gave this completely weird, mind-warped answer that was, as you say, crazy.
But I think maybe that's sort of what he does to us. He drives us all off topic, because there is no topic, you know. There is no there is no decision, there is no plan, there is no grand vision. In a way, we were kind of soothing ourselves with the idea of Dominic Cummings as this evil genius, because at least somebody had a plan.
Hello, it's Anna here. I wanted to let you know about a really important campaign that I'm involved in. In Poland, abortion rights are currently under attack like never before, but the resistance is huge. Women and their allies have taken the streets in unprecedented numbers. Another Europe has been helping organize protests and build international solidarity with Polish women, because we believe that reproductive rights shouldn't stop at borders. So please support this struggle, and consider joining Another Europe Is Possible today.
To jump in our time machine back to 2016, 2017, it's fair to say that this situation we're in is not exactly what was promised previously by the politicians that backed Brexit. Liam Fox once referred to it as the easiest trade deal the UK would ever do, for example. Do you think this has been a learning curve for the pro-Brexit faction as well as for Remainers? Or do you think they never believed their own claim that it would be really easy to do?
I think it's remarkable how little lesson learning has taken place. And it is just quite extraordinary what people can get away with saying obviously I'm thinking particularly of politicians, but not just that, but just the lack of awareness of the EU and how it works and indeed the nature of trade deals, etc. And I would go further and suggest, you know, the sort of awareness in maybe certain parts of London around the nature of the United Kingdom itself, you know, the importance of devolution, etc. I mean, just I find it remarkable that things can carry on and things become at a point of crisis or certainly intense pressure, and people don't seem to move onwards in terms of their knowledge of the matter. And this isn't just from the Leave side, I think it's the Remain side too, to some degree. And I think this is possibly why maybe we are where we are, where those headline issues, and we've known them for some time, but particularly why fish can be the thing that is make or break potentially on this deal, no deal. How can it be? We've got to this point, this extraordinarily momentous agreement. We've got, 14 working days, as I speak, before the end of the transition period, and we don't know what's going to happen on the 1st of January. I mean, just how do we get to this point? Certainly nobody could possibly have predicted this. And it's been quite a year, but COVID's only a small part of it. I think just those patterns of not learning lessons and not building on information have just remained remarkably resistant.
I love that as the kind of a motto of Brexit. How could it be? Now that we are, you know, at the worst place we could possibly be, I feel like it's sort of inevitable. But you're right that it is very, very strange.
I liked your self-reflection on this in The Guardian, actually, Zoe.
Well, I kind of wrote that in a fury because I felt like I didn't want to be lectured by Len McCluskey about how this was all Remainer's fault. And as I was writing it, Owen Jones, who I really like as a human being, was doing exactly the same thing and saying if Remainers had been prepared to compromise, then we could have got Theresa May's deal through, everything would have been fine. It's actually not true, because what chased Brexit into this corner was the people who wanted an ever harder Brexit, wanting an ever harder Brexit. And the truth of it is that the Brexiters never wanted the same thing. You know, some of them wanted a kind of bonfire of red tape, you know, aka regulations and decency and standards, and others wanted a kind of more Trumpian protectionist style arrangement. And those interests weren't aligned. They were so conflicted within their own program that they were always backing each other into a more extreme corner. And I don't really think that has anything to do with the Remain case, but certainly it's an absolute tragedy.
Absolutely. I mean, on the theme as well, as Katie was saying, on not learning, I felt that Boris Johnson's comments in Parliament were also really revealing, not in relation to India, but in relation to this trade agreement, arguing that no British Prime Minister could sign up to a deal where the EU had the right to introduce tariffs if the UK diverged from EU rules and regulations.
If they pass a new law in the future with which we in this country do not comply or don't follow suit, then they want the automatic right, Mr. Speaker, to punish us and to retaliate.
And I was watching this thinking, almost in a state of bewilderment, to be honest, because he is arguing that in order for the UK to have sovereignty, 27 other sovereign nations need to refuse their own right, which surely is their sovereign right, to introduce tariffs on British goods if they want to or not. I mean, how can you have such a one-sided and illogical, frankly, conception of what sovereignty is? I just found it incredible. I don't know if you saw this, Katie.
I didn't see it, but I'm not surprised to hear it. It's a little bit silly to say, but it feels like sovereignty means not being able to see past the end of your nose, to quote yeah. Mary Poppins. And again, the interesting thing about these Brexit negotiations is in part that they are, you know, the biggest drama and the biggest moves have been very much domestic. So even what we saw earlier this week with the, you know, the clauses in the UK Internal Market Bill, etc. But that's all about the domestic dance and choreography rather than necessarily thinking it's going to make any difference vis-a-vis the EU.
Is there a danger that we're looking at this too much from our own side and that we haven't considered Because sometimes I just think, why doesn't the EU just say enough already? I've had enough of you. And is there a danger that even British negotiators haven't really considered how the EU feels about this? And, you know, even if they think they're going to pull something out of the bag at the very last minute, it just might be that they've had enough of us.
The EU has to take into account, you know, the real impact that, you know, a no deal would have, including, of course, on Ireland. So there are rationales and sort of forward long-term thinking in the way that the EU is approaching all of this. I mean, let's bear in mind, too, that these negotiations won't finish this year, that you'll have a lot of issues that will still need to be dealt with and addressed in the coming months and years. So this relationship with the UK, it's very tiresome at the moment, but it's not one that they're going to be able to shift anytime soon.
This might be a very short question, I don't know. But you've followed the Brexit talks an awful lot, it's fair to say, even more closely than this podcast. Have you ever heard a Brexiteer give an example of a regulation that they want to diverge from? Because we get all of this abstract discussion around the freedom to deregulate, but when they're asked about a specific example, they don't seem to be able to give one. Is that right?
Yes, no, I haven't. I can't say I've heard many specific examples. I mean, you've seen a little bit on the state aid question and the hints that, you know, maybe I think Cummings is meant to be supportive of this, like sort of investment in particular in, you know, digital technology and maybe even environmental initiatives or whatever, which then gave rise to some concern in Northern Ireland because we would still be under EU state aid rules. But yeah, no, beyond that, I haven't heard any real substantial engagement in that particular question of, well, okay, so, you know, why? let's just why? That's the outstanding question. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sort of captures some of the symbolism of it, really, or the emphasis on symbolism from the English side. And we probably should call it the English side more often. You have this sort of abstract commitment and desire that, you know, you don't want to be under the Brussels rules and everything. But when it comes to actually listing out specific environmental protections, our food standards, our workers' rights are already probably the least strong in the entirety of Western Europe. You know, so it's hard to see how you could deregulate them anymore. You know, there just aren't many specific examples that they can give. And it's sort of one of the most frustrating elements of the project, which kind of comes back to what you were saying, Zoe, because insofar as it was given a content, it was given a content by Dominic Cummings. It was this Trumpist state aid. We're going to invest a lot in disruptive tech companies. There'll be a bit of crony capitalism. We'll get out of the state aid rules and we'll transform our economy that way and we'll level up left behind Britain and all of this stuff. The Cummings agenda gave it a content that it probably didn't have in the minds of the Peter Bone tendency in the Conservative Party, where it was a kind of pure abstraction almost.
When people say, look, this is driven by, you know, financial interests who enjoy volatility and don't like regulation, so that's actually a very small number of businesses. That's hedge funds basically, and maybe to a degree property developers, but it's mainly in the world of very high finance that volatility is a good thing. And everybody else is screwed by it. So I think where you can discern somebody who's thinking about that interest and pursuing Brexit for that reason is almost more reassuring than when you just see people like Marc Francois who don't have a clue, or people like Caroline Flint saying, you know, we need to be out of the EU so that we can rebuild manufacturing. And you're thinking, what? You know, this is just so outside scope of any understanding of how economies and trade and globalization work. I suppose what I'm saying is I feel less frightened when I see somebody who at least has a plan than when I see people who are doing it purely for the rhetoric. And I think the logic of Parliament and what is really kind of uncovered is that there's a huge amount of mileage in simply, you know, saying a thing. There's very little punishment for pushing something to a more extreme point, but there's a huge, you get a huge amount of payback for being the person who pushed it, because, you know, you get notoriety, you get attention, you get you kind of feel sort of buoyed up by it. And that's what I'm finding really frightening, that I think we're kind of, we've just got to a place where the people in charge don't have a plan, but they also, there's a kind of narcissism that drives them, which I can't imagine would be helpful for anything.
For me, that's one of the biggest lessons of the last 4 years, and one of the frustrating elements of how this topic is still discussed, is that it's mainly a question of rhetoric, clever messaging, and electoral calculations. Whereas it has never really been a question of how do you want to govern and what relationship do you need with Europe in order to do the things in government that you want to do? What's your plan? And we seem to have walked into, or sleepwalked into, a situation where we now celebrate government without a plan. Government through communication and messaging without thinking, well, what's our underlying basis? What do we want to achieve? That concludes this podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. But the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we ask Katie about the state of politics in Northern Ireland and how protected the polity is from no deal. It's a good chat. If you want to listen to it, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the European left in Britain. You can join at anothereurope.org/join. Doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.
What's the view in Ireland? I mean, the people must be very angry, right? I mean, the DUP have been completely stiffed, and the nation of Ireland is being treated like it's the problem when it's not. Is there a lot of anger about it?
You've definitely seen a lot of expressions of frustration. We have the coalition government now, and the political leaders in that have both, you know, been very careful not to come across as being too harsh or say anything that would be, you know, probably not to speak as bluntly as they might otherwise speak, I should put it that way, given the sensitivities in all of this, and most particularly, you know, given the situation in Northern Ireland, which is so distinct, is so very much, you know, is so vulnerable to the outcome of this UK-EU negotiation. It feels a live issue and a hugely consequential one in a way that is quite distinct, I think. And so you're definitely seeing that sense of nervousness.
So the Northern Ireland backstop means that in some respects, Northern Ireland is relatively protected from the effects of no deal. But on the other hand, the impact on its trade with the mainland UK is going to be really quite profound. So it is really affected by no deal. Could you talk to us about that contradiction, Katie?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to, because because it is, yeah, this is my forte. But absolutely. So the protocol on Ireland, Northern Ireland, that we have as part of the withdrawal agreement, certainly puts Northern Ireland in a distinct position. And this position, unlike the backstop as we had under Theresa May, this position stands in such a way that it doesn't tie the rest of the United Kingdom into anything in particular. So what we have is a situation in which even a no-deal Brexit would not disrupt the movement of goods across the Irish land border. So we're avoiding a hard Irish land border, which is great. But a no-deal Brexit in particular, or indeed a very hard Brexit, does mean harder borders all around Northern Ireland. So in order to avoid the hard Irish land border for the movement of goods, that border has now moved into the Irish Sea. So if we have a UK-EU trade deal, that does very much affect the movement of goods across the Irish Sea in terms of avoiding tariffs, etc. If we have a no deal, then that has an impact on the movement of goods across the Irish Sea, so from one part of the UK to Northern Ireland. We are hearing some rumours, and we haven't seen the detail of it yet, we are hearing some rumours of some arrangements to avoid the hardness of an Irish sea border that we'd most feared. So Gove and Sefcovic apparently came to some kind of deal earlier this week that would avoid the imposition of tariffs, for example, on most goods moving GB to NI, even in the event of a no deal, so that's good. But a no deal is about much more than movement of goods and much more than tariffs. So, for example, if you have a no deal in relation to data adequacy, no agreement from the EU to recognise data protection in the UK, that would immediately disrupt the degree to which the Garda Síochána in the south and the police service of Northern Ireland could cooperate. And police forces all across Europe cooperate very closely, but this is particularly true across the Irish land border. Also, it means we wouldn't have movement of services across the Irish border. And it would also affect various other matters in relation to workers, etc. So there is a concern that people think Northern Ireland is kind of sorted, but in actual fact, we really do need a deal to avoid those hard borders all around Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland doesn't cope well with borders. It's a very conflictual topic, and so you can imagine how everybody here is feeling rather insecure and really hoping that there is at least some good news by the end of the week.
And what about that element of the kind of Northern Irish situation in which the EU, the Republic of Ireland and Westminster will all have input on the laws applying in Northern Ireland, but Stormont won't have any input? I mean, surely people are quite enraged about that.
So what we did get in this protocol is the consent vote. So at the end of 2024, the Northern Ireland MLAs will get to vote on whether to keep certain part of the protocol, i.e. that part relating to trade. And that's, you know, we've sort of been fobbed off with that as if, well, that's your bit of democracy as it relates to the protocol. Unionists are very anxious, of course, or unsurprisingly, I should say, about the protocol, given that it does place Northern Ireland in an even more distinct position than it was already in. But more broadly, I think we do have concerns. And fundamentally, you know, the whole idea of the Good Friday Agreement is that democratic representation works, you know, that it's worth voting and that there is some means of affecting, obviously, the laws and decisions that shape your life. These decisions that will be made for Northern Ireland in the Joint Committee for the foreseeable future, so that's the committee chair by Gove and Sefcovic. I mean, those decisions affect huge matters of concern for Northern Ireland, and we'll also have dynamic alignment to EU rules in certain areas. So it's a big deal, and it does mean that we will end up, if GB diverges considerably, we will end up in a very unique place trying to balance being on the edge of the EU and on the edge of the UK. So yeah, you're absolutely right to mention that concern about democratic representation, because at the moment it's sorely lacking.
I must admit to be quite curious and fascinated, as we talked before actually on this podcast, to see it happen. It's just such a change to politics and economics that inevitably inspires curiosity in whatever form that Brexit now takes, whether it's no deal or whether it's this very hard Brexit. But I mean, you know, Brexit has always been a kind of act of economic war against the island of Ireland in a way. You could see it because it's just so bad for the Irish economy. But of course, in any kind of negative economic scenario, there will be ways out of it. And I think the ways out of it could end up being quite interesting. You know, there's going to be German and French producers that are going to be eyeing up the Irish market and thinking, well, we're probably going to be able to sell a lot more goods here. There's going to be more economic convergence between the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland and the rest of the European single market. And, you know, it might even be possible that Northern Ireland has some benefits from this situation, because it would, after all, be the only part of the United Kingdom in the European single market. So in this chaos, there are probably still elements of hope. In principle, societies should be able to deal with this disruption. I guess the argument against that in the Northern Ireland setting is that it's a post-conflict society, it's got quite dysfunctional government and so on. So it's going to maybe, if there's a society in the world you wouldn't want to have this kind of economic experiment in, it's probably Northern Ireland is that society, right?
You're absolutely right. I mean, these challenges are huge. You're absolutely right to point to the fact that, you know, the all-Ireland economy, Northern Ireland's access, free access to the EU single market for goods, I mean, those things are great benefits potentially. And the EU isn't slow to remind the UK of what it's conceding for Northern Ireland. But on the other hand, so you've got the practicalities of that. So these things take time to adjust to. I mean, Northern Ireland is very closely integrated with the UK internal market. It's by far its largest market for goods, both, you know, for sales and for products that it buys. So it takes time to readjust to new opportunities, but most particularly politically, it's hugely sensitive. So, for example, the First Minister and Deputy First Minister, Arlene Foster and Michelle O'Neill, DUP and Sinn Féin, respectively, they wrote a letter a couple of weeks ago to the Commission saying, listen, if you don't, you know, please could be nice to us in your decisions around the operation of the protocol, particularly give us a little bit of leeway when it comes to implementing it in the early stages, because we're worried about food supply into Northern Ireland. So that's quite a big issue. But they got an awful lot of stick, and they got stick from their own constituency, their own party bases, and from wider commentary, partly because Brexit is just such a toxic issue. It's toxic in across GB, of course, but in Northern Ireland, on both sides, it seemed as betrayal. So for the DUP to be even engaging at all with the protocol, let alone, my goodness me, could you imagine them trying to say, well, there are opportunities on the all-island economy? I mean, it's just something that's very, very, it's almost impossible to see, certainly at this present time. And then for Sinn Féin, again, engaging with Brexit, trying to find solutions for the problems brought on by Brexit, which they opposed to begin with. It's such a horrible environment for trying to plot a sort of logical, balanced way out of, yeah.
Now, I disagree with Luke's last question, the one that I disagree with the premise, but for the benefit of the listeners, I'm going to tell you what it is, which is that should the DUP have voted for Theresa May's deal in the first place, then they wouldn't be in this mess. The reason I disagree is that you cannot apply the hindsight of now to anything Theresa May did, because no rational person could possibly have guessed how self-destructive the plan would become. And, you know, Theresa May's deal did breach their red lines. And what's the point having red lines if you'll just kind of give them up on the basis that something else worse could be around the corner? But is there anything that a kind of smarter strategist would have done previously?
Can I just interject?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can even ask.
Well, I would. I think whenever we're talking about this issue, maybe we always distinguish between the politicians and the people that voted for them. It's just quite a healthy distinction to make, isn't it? I think the people that vote for the DUP are not responsible for the fact that leading DUP politicians spoke on Brexit Party platforms that were completely relaxed about the idea of no deal. And despite the huge sort of economic and political and cultural implications that has for the north of Ireland. So clearly there are DUP politicians, and perhaps it's not the whole of the DUP, who were extremely cavalier about the Brexit issue. So I defend my framing, but I'm interested in what Katie has to say here too.
So I'll just say two things, and they're purely anecdotal. So one is, yesterday I was on a BBC lunchtime phone-in programme, in which I guess I'm supposed to be sort of the expert, but then politicians as well. And one of the politicians was a former MEP from the Brexit Party. And he was saying that the protocol is a horrendous betrayal of Northern Ireland and of the Union and all of this, and saying Northern Ireland's been annexed off, and et cetera, et cetera, and that the Irish land border question was a made-up problem, which is something that we hear quite a lot amongst unionists. But this is a kind of concern, that this sense of, well, we are where we are because of nationalists, or because of, indeed, people suggesting that there could have been violence if we'd have had a hard border as a result of Brexit, a hard border across the island of Ireland. So this is a worry, and you can see how more of that language would just be very destabilizing in the longer term. And the fact it was coming from a Brexit Party MEP, I don't know if he's ever visited Northern Ireland, but that was kind of unnerving too, in a certain way, stirring up stuff that has a real visceral quality here in terms of memories of violence. And then the other thing was, this morning, Lord Dodds, Nigel Dodds, whom you'll remember as a previous DUP MP in Westminster, he was being asked about the backstop in the protocol this morning on Good Morning Ulster. And he started talking about the rights and wrongs of the Good Friday Belfast Agreement and the St Andrews Agreement. And, you know, it was just such a classic. It was just this sense of, you can't talk about any of this without it getting into them and us and the nationalist unionist challenge and debate, and just how uneasy they are sharing power. And you can never escape that sense of, as I say, I've mentioned it several times now, but that sense of insecurity and vulnerability, which should be treated so very carefully. And this is why when I'm thinking about whether there's a deal or no deal, we had all sorts of games being played over Northern Ireland at the beginning of this week. I really want to emphasise the point that, you know, if we do have a no deal for Northern Ireland, it would be extremely destabilising in really significant ways.
Whew. So let's hope that it doesn't happen.
Is that really the note you want to end on, Luke?
We don't have a great deal of power in this situation, of course. But thanks so much for coming on to talk to us, Katie. It's been so good to talk to you again.
You too. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really nice talking to you again.